As to the records of stigmatics, I omit the best known, and most convincingly reported, of all the cases, the case of the French girl, Louise Leto, because much has been published upon her phenomena, and because accounts are easily available. In the newspapers of July, 1922, I take from the London Daily Express, July 10th, was reported the case of Mary Riley, aged 20, in the home of the Sisters of the Good Shepherd, Peekskill, NY. It was said that intermittently, upon her side, appeared a manifestation in the form of a cross of blood. Mostly the appearances are of the five wounds of Christ, or six, including marks on the forehead. For an account of the case of Rose Farron, see the New York Herald Tribune, March 25, 1928. According to this story, Rose Farron, aged 25, of 86, Asylum Street Woundsocket, RI, had, since March 17, 1916, been astigmatic, wounds appearing upon her hands, feet, and forehead. The hysterical condition of this girl in both the common and the medical meaning of the term is indicated by the circumstance that for 3 years she had been strapped to her bed, with only her right arm free. At this time of writing, I have, for 4 years, been keeping track of the case of Teresa Newman, the stigmatic girl of Konnersreuth, Germany, and, up to this time, there has been no exposure of imposture. See the New York Times, April 8, 1928. Roads leading to her home jammed with automobiles, carriages, motorcycles, vans, and pilgrims on foot. Considering the facilities or the facilities, if nothing goes wrong of modern travel, it is probable that no other miracle has been so multitudinously witnessed. A girl in bed and all day long, the tramp of thousands passed her. Whether admission was charged, I do not know. The story of this girl agrees with the stories of other stigmatics, flows of blood, from quick healing wounds, and phenomena on Fridays. It was said that medical men had become interested, and had demanded Teresa's removal to a clinic, where she could be subjected to a prolonged examination, but that the church authorities had objected. This is about what would be expected of church authorities, and that the medical men, unable to have their own way, then disregarded the case is something else that is about what would be expected. My expression is that, upon stigmatic girls have appeared wounds, similar to the alleged wounds of a historical, and therefore doubtful, character, because this melodrama is most strikingly stimulative to the imagination, but that an atheistic girl, if there could be anything for an atheistic girl to be equally imaginatively hysterical about, might reproduce other representations upon her body. In the month, 134-249, is an account of Marie-Julie Jehenny, of the village of La Fraudeus, Loire-en-Ferrur, France, who, upon March 21, 1873, became astigmatic. Upon her body appeared the five wounds. Then, upon her breast appeared the picture of a flower. It is said that for 20 years this picture of a flower remained visible. According to the story, it was in the mind of the girl before it appeared upon her body, because she predicted that it would appear. One has notions of the possible use of indelible ink, or of tattooing. That is very good. One should have notions. If a girl drinks a liquid that would harm nobody else, and dies, can a man inflict upon himself injuries that would kill anybody else, and be unharmed? There is a kind of stigmatism that differs from the foregoing cases, in that weapons are used to bring on effects, but the wounds are similar to the wounds of stigmatic girls, or simply are not wounds, in an ordinary, physical sense. There is an account, in the Sphinx, March, 1893, of a fakir, Solomon Ben Issa, who was exhibiting in Germany, who stabbed daggers into his cheeks and tongue, and into his abdomen, harmlessly, and with quick healing wounds. Such magicians are of rare occurrence, anyway in the United States and Europe, but the minor ones who eat glass and swallow nails are not uncommon. But, if in Germany, or anywhere else, in countries that are said to be Christian, any man ever did savagely stab himself in the abdomen, and be unhurt, and repeat his performances, How is it that the phenomenon is not well known and generally accepted? The question is like another. If, in the theological era, a man went around blaspheming, during thunderstorms, and was unheard, though churches were struck by lightning, how long would he remain well known? In March, 1920, a band of Arab dervishes exhibited in the London music halls. In the London Daily News, March 12, 1920, are reproduced photographs of these magicians, showing them with skewers that they had thrust through their flesh, painlessly and bloodlessly. Taboo. The censor stopped the show. For an account of phenomena, or alleged phenomena, of the Seilschian cobbler, Paul Diebel, who exhibited in Berlin, in December, 1927, see the New York Times, December 18, 1927. Blood flows from his eyes, and open wounds appear on his chest, after he has concentrated mentally for 6 minutes, it is declared. He drives daggers through his arms and legs, and even permits himself to be nailed to a cross, without any suffering, it is said. His manager asserts that he can remain thus for 10 hours. His self-inflicted wounds, it is declared, bleed or not, as he wishes, and a few minutes after the knife or nails are withdrawn, all evidence of incisions vanishes. The only thing that can be said against this story is that it is unbelievable. New York Herald Tribune, February 6, 1928. That, in Vienna, the police had interfered with Diebel, and had forbidden him to perform. It was explained that this was because he would not give them a free exhibition, to prove the genuineness of his exhibitions. In Munich, recently, he remained nailed to a cross several hours, smoking cigarettes and joking with his audience. After April 8, 1928, see the New York Times of this date, I lose track of Paul Diebel. The story ends with an explanation. Nothing is said of the alleged crucifixions. The explanation is a retreat to statements that are supposed to be understandable in commonplace terms. I do not think that they are so understandable. Diebel has disclosed his secret to the public, saying that shortly before his appearance, he scratched his flesh with his fingernails, or a sharp instrument, being careful not to cut it. On the stage, by contracting his muscles, those formerly invisible lines assumed blood-red hue and often bled. I have heard of other persons, who have disclosed trade secrets. Upon March 2, 1931, a man lay, most publicly, upon a bed of nails. See the New York Herald Tribune, March 3, 1931. In Union Square, New York City, an unoriental magician, named Brahman, from the unmystical region of Pelham Bay, in the Bronx, gave an exhibition that was staged by the magazine Science and Invention. This fakir from the Bronx lay upon a bed of 1,200 nails. In response to his invitation, 10 men walked on his body, pressing the points of the nails into his back. He stood up, showing deep, red marks made by the nails. These marks soon faded away. I have thought of leaf insects as pictorial representations wrought in the bodies of insects, by their imaginations, or by the imaginative qualities of the substances of their bodies back in plastic times, when insects were probably not so set in their ways as they now are. The conventional explanation of protective colorations and formations has, as to some of these insects, considerable reasonableness. But there is one of these creatures, the Tasmanian leaf insect, that represents an artistry that so transcends utility that I considered the specimen that I saw, in the American Museum of Natural History, misplaced. It should have been in the Metropolitan Museum of Art. This leaf insect has reproduced the appearance of a leaf down to such tiny details as serrated edges. The deception of enemies, or survival value, has had nothing thinkable to do with some of the making of this remarkable likeness, because such minute particulars as serrations would be invisible to any bird, unless so close that the undisguisable insect characteristics would be apparent. I now have the case of what I consider a stigmatic bird. It is most unprotectively marked. Upon its breast it bears betrayal, or it is so conspicuously marked that one doubts that there is much for the theory of protective coloration to base upon, if conspicuously marked forms of life survive everywhere, and if many of them cannot be explained away, as Darwin explained away some of them, in terms of warnings. It is a story of the sensitiveness of pigeons. I have told of the pigeons with whom I was acquainted. One day a boy shot one, and the body lay where the others saw it. They were so nervous that they flew, hearing trifling sounds that, before, they'd not have noticed. They were so suspicious that they kept away from the window sills. For a month they remembered. The bleeding heart pigeon of the Philippines, the spot of red on its breast, or that its breast remembered. Or once upon a time back in plastic times when the forms and plumages of birds were not so fixed, or established, as they now are, an ancestral pigeon and her mate. The swoop of a hawk, a wound on his breast, and that sentiment in her plumage was so sympathetically moved that it stigmatized her, or reproduced on offsprings, and is to this day the recorded impression of an ancient little tragedy. A simple red spot on the breast of a bird would not be conceived of, by me, as having any such significance. It is not a simple, red spot, only vaguely suggestive of a wound, on the breast of the bleeding heart pigeon of the Philippines. The bordering red feathers are stiff, as if clotted. They have the appearance of coagulation. Conceiving of the transmission of a pictorial representation, by heredity, is conceiving of external stigmatism, but of internal origin. If I could think that a human being's intense mental state, at the sight of a wound, had marked a pigeon, that would be more of a span over our gap. But I have noted an observation for thinking that the sight of a dead and mutilated pigeon may intensely affect the imaginations of other pigeons. If anybody thinks that birds have not imagination, let him tell me with what a parrot of mine foresees what I am going to do to him, when I catch him up to some of his mischief, such as gouging furniture. The body of a dead and mutilated companion prints on the minds of other pigeons, but I have not a datum for thinking that the skeleton, or any part of the skeleton, of a pigeon, would be of any meaning to other pigeons. I have never heard of anything that indicates that in the mind of any other living thing is the mystic awe that human beings, or most human beings, have for bones.